My name is Randy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Randy!
Thank you for that warm and wonderful welcome. I've also brought my fisherman's friend along here. Hopefully I won't cough too much, and I'll try not to cough directly into the mic. When Judy got up earlier today, Niall was sitting beside me, and he leaned over and he said, "Are you a member of Al-Anon?" And I said, "No." And then after hearing Judy share, and I related on so many different levels, now I'm thinking, okay, maybe. And you'll hear later on, I married another alcoholic. We were both in AA at the time. And there was an issue around drinking in our family when I was quite young. So now I'm starting to wonder, maybe I should be in more than just AA. So you may have captured someone here today. The other thing that amazed me was Rick's presentation workshop on sponsorship, and he mentioned that he thought maybe we were in shock, and for me it was shock and awe, because I've been around long enough, I've heard many workshops and presentations on sponsorship, and I've never heard one better than that. I thank you for that, Rick, and I know I can use that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to start with a bit of a disclaimer to let you know that what you hear here this afternoon is not the viewpoint or necessarily of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's simply my own experience, strength, and hope in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and how I've applied the 12 steps to the best of my ability in my life. I was looking at your theme, Journey to Serenity, and you know, it's just kind of amazing the way this fellowship works, and we all learn from each other, and we continue to learn as we go. And I was driving back. I had gone down. That's why I wasn't here last night. I went down. My son was playing in his first ever midget AAA game down in Notre Dame. So I drove down to Wilcox to watch him. And I was driving back last night. And it was just a little after midnight. And I still had about an hour to go to get back to Saskatoon. And I looked up in the sky and I saw the Northern Lights. And they were just absolutely brilliant last night. And they were changing shape and changing brilliance. And above them were the stars. It was a clear sky. And out the window to the west was a half moon, and it was bright. And I had been sitting in the car, and I was going through one of the three talks that I have. And when I saw the Northern Lights and the beauty of the sky and the night and everything else, I came to that realization yet again of what a small part I am of this, you know, and that comes from someone who's been told that his disease, the selfishness and self-centeredness, is the root of all my problems, and you know, to realize that I'm just a very, very small part, and at that moment, you know, I just felt this warmth in the car and complete serenity. And I've had those feelings before, but I felt it again last night. And so that was just one part of my journey to serenity. And I'm grateful for that experience. As I mentioned, I am an alcoholic. I, too, was born in Toronto. I was born and raised in Toronto, but I did my growing up in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous here in Saskatoon. I mentioned that there was some issues around drinking when I was young, and you know, I didn't think of them that way. Most of the things you're going to hear today are all in hindsight, because I didn't have these realizations at the time. They all came to me later. And I thought it was actually quite cool. When I was 16 years old, my dad lost his driver's license. He was coming back on a flight from Montreal, and he ran over a motorcycle police officer leaving the airport. He ran over the motorcycle, not the police officer. So he lost his license for 6 months. And, of course, there was the big cover-up. Well, yeah, he had one or two drinks, but, you know, he was on medication for this and that and all these other things. But I thought it was great because I'd just gotten my driver's license. So I got to drive him to work, and then I got to take the red convertible to school, and I was a big wig, you know, and so I didn't see any problem with alcohol there. And, you know, and I don't remember a great deal about my growing up, but one thing I remember clearly is right at the bottom of the stairs there was a well-stocked bar, and I remember the sign over the bar: "I do not have an alcohol problem. I drink, I get drunk, I fall down, no problem." you know, and I remember that quite clearly. And I also remember the occasions where my dad was a very funny man. Well, he still is a funny man. Humorous and good wit and such. But I remember he used to always have to have a few drinks before Mom and Dad went out to a party, and then he'd come back and he'd be sick the next morning, and we had to tiptoe around and be quiet and all those things, you know. And But I didn't make that connection. My own drinking started when I was about 16 years old. I was at a hockey tournament out in Peterborough, outside of Toronto. And we had won the tournament, and we were staying in the hotel that night before we went back the next morning. And the coaches were down in one room with some of the parents, and the players were in another room, and a couple of kids brought out some bottles of Silk Tassel. And so we mixed those in the hotel tumblers with some Coke, and that was my first drink. And I remember it smelt bad, it tasted worse, and it burnt all the way down. But the first thing I did when that glass was empty is I went, more. And for anybody that says, you know, you can't have a blackout the first time you drink, I'm here to tell you that that's not true. Because the next part of the evening was told to me by my fellow teammates, because I blacked out. I have no clue of what went on after that, other than that we ran out of Coke, so I just started drinking Silk Tassel straight. And the more I could get, the better. And, you know, most of the other guys on the team, I mean, they maybe sipped half a glass and it tasted terrible. They didn't even finish it. But I just kept pouring it down. And we went back to the room where the coaches were sitting around, some of the parents, and apparently they were playing cards on one of the beds. And I was standing there watching, and all of a sudden I threw up on their card game and then passed out face first and fell onto the bed. And I woke up the next morning in the room. There was four of us in the room, two in each double bed, and I was in the bed all by myself, surrounded by my own vomit. Two of the guys were in the other bed, and one of the other guys was sleeping in the chair. It was cold out, it was winter time, the window was open to get the stench out of the room, and that was the start of my drinking career. And I vowed the next morning that I would never do that again. And I never did. I never drank Silk Tassel as long as I drank. It talks in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in chapter 3 more about alcoholism, about, you know, Silk Tassel was the problem, so I had to drink something else. And it must have been the mix, so I changed to something else. And I just kept changing my drinks and my locations and my places and so on in my drinking career, if you want to call it that. The second time, basically the same effect. One of the guys I was playing hockey with, this was maybe a year and a half later, we were going to go downtown Toronto and skate at Nathan Phillips Square New Year's Eve. And I was a little naive, too. I showed up at his place with my skates, and he said, "What are you doing with those?" And I said, "Oh, aren't we going skating to..." And he said, "No, leave those here." And we headed downtown, and we went from bar to bar to bar. And whichever bar we could get in and whichever bar would serve us, we drank as much as we could. And we got back to his place at about 10:30 at night. We didn't even make midnight. And Joe passed out, and I passed out, and his younger brother couldn't rouse either of us, and he panicked, and he called my parents. So my parents came over to Joe's to pick me up. And that was when the shame and the regret and the remorse started kicking in, because now I'd ruined my parents' New Year's. And, you know, of course, they let me know that, too. I mean, because they were going here or there, or they had people over, whatever it was. But, you know, I had ruined their evening, and I felt guilty for that. And I felt the shame and the regret and the remorse, and I vowed I wouldn't do that again. You know, and yet I did it on many, many, many occasions. That's not to say that every time I drank, I got drunk and passed out. There were occasions where I could go to a bar or a lounge and have a drink or two and go home. The problem was that I never, once I had that first glass, I never knew what the result was going to be. I didn't know if I was going to go home that night, the next day, if I was going to my home, someone else's home. I just never knew. In university, it continued. I managed to get through university. One of the things I did in my final year of university is I ran for the student council at the University of Toronto, and I ran for vice president, because the vice president got to be in charge of the student-run pub. And so I didn't want to be the president. I wanted to be the guy looking after the pub. And, of course, I was right, too, as I got free beer and you know, it was great. At least I thought so at the time. I went on from there. I graduated, and I took a job with a large accounting firm right down at King and Bay, and I had an office on the 33rd floor of the Commerce Court building down at King and Bay, and I was on top of the world, and I was going to make $1 million by the time I was 30, and I got into a little trouble with that job, with drinking. And I didn't always get caught, but, you know, I knew they were catching on, so what happened was that there was a posting for a senior accountant in Saskatoon. And I was a senior accountant in the Toronto office, and I thought, boy, that would be a good career move to leave King and Bay, the heart of the financial district, as an accountant and come out to Saskatoon. That would be a great career move. So I put my name in, and a few months later, sight unseen, I arrived in Saskatoon. And I realize now, in hindsight, what the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me was that that was a geographic cure, not a career move. But at the time, that's what I thought. And I was one of these people, too, that I always wanted to be someone else, somewhere else, doing something else. Even if I was sitting in a bar, at one table and there was more laughter over there, they were obviously having more fun, I wanted to be over there. If I was with one woman and someone else looked better, I wanted to be with her because she was obviously better looking. And it didn't matter. And so when I arrived in Saskatoon, here's a guy, I was 25 years old, always lived in Toronto, but I was out west now. So I was going to fit in out here. So what I did is I bought a Stetson and a pair of cowboy boots, a Ford Bronco, and I started hanging out at the Barquet. And needless to say, I didn't fit in. So that wasn't working so well. So what I'm going to do is, it was kind of early 80s. It was the time of the yuppies. So I sold the Bronco. I threw away the boots. They never did fit very well. Got rid of the Stetson, and I bought a couple of Armani suits and a Boss suit and a BMW, and I was going to be a yuppie. There weren't a whole lot of yuppies in Saskatoon at that time, and so I didn't really fit in there either. And what I've come to realize, in hindsight and through my learnings in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that it wasn't about me not fitting in. And it was the same, you know, in my family. I always kind of felt that I never really fit in. It was about me wanting to be somewhere else, to be someone else doing something else. It was about my selfishness and my self-centeredness. Everyone went out of their way to make me fit in. But it was me, it was my own feelings, and that's why I didn't fit in. And so I left Pete Marwick. Again, you know, things were getting a little dicey at the time with my job here. I left Pete Marwick. I joined the federal government. I won't mention what department, Rick. And I started my career with them. And one of the things that was great about that job is I traveled 1 week a month. And I could sit at my desk for a couple of weeks and plan that 1 week travel. And I knew I'd get a meal allowance, and if I didn't eat a whole lot, I'd have more money to drink with when we were out of town. And so really, those out-of-town trips just became drinking binges for me. And then eventually it became that it wasn't just 1 week a month wasn't enough. Again, I was going to the bars in town here and drinking. And again, and a lot of times it was, you know, you go with the guys after work for one drink. And sure enough, they'd have one drink and go home, and I'd stay. You know, and I could never figure that out, why it was they would go home. And I kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, if they had the wife that I had, they'd stay too. That's my own mind and my own thinking. And I refer to that as my keen alcoholic mind. And there's many, many instances where that keen alcoholic mind has gotten me into a lot of trouble. Needless to say, and this is where it gets confusing. I sometimes think maybe I should have a flow chart. I say this not because I'm proud of it, but there's three wives, so try and keep them straight. Not because I'm proud of it, actually. It's one of the things, you know, I wish. We can't go back. We can't do things differently. But alcoholism played a huge part in the destruction of those families. And that's why I like this sign with the family there, because it truly is a family disease. And my first wife, she didn't really appreciate me coming home at 3 o'clock in the morning with my new best friends and opening up the liquor cabinet and putting on the William Tell 1812 Overture full blast on the stereo. Something about her having to go to work the next day. And so, needless to say, that marriage broke down. And, you know, when she left, I remember, again, my keen alcoholic mind thinking, well, that's fine, now I can drink without having to come home and be, you know, criticized for it or chewed out or in the doghouse, you know. And so my drinking took off. But being the ever-smart alcoholic, I was also able to control my drinking enough to find another woman. And so, of course, I got into another relationship, and shortly thereafter, we got married. And I controlled my drinking for a while. And then again, in that relationship, I started drinking a little more. And, you know, once we were married, I mean, what's she going to do about it? I mean, she's married to me, you know, for better or for worse. Maybe they should add for drinking, too, but... And so, again, it just started all over again. The issues, and of course, the drinking led to money issues, and the pretenses. You know, we had this house out in the newer area, Saskatoon, two new cars, you know, the nice suits, the whole works, but it was all a false front. None of it was true. You know, I didn't know anything about Randy, and inside those walls there was fighting and things going on, and I was a cocky drunk as well. I said to her one time, you know, if you don't believe me, have me followed. So she took me up on that offer. And I left the house one day at 6 a.m. To go golfing. And I got back about 4 a.m. the next morning. And she'd had me followed the whole time. And the crazy part was I had gone and picked up a neighbor one block over and taking him to the golf course, and we had a couple of beer after the golf game, and then I drove him home. I dropped him off a block from my house, and I proceeded from there to go back downtown to an instant teller, take out some money, and start drinking. And I know this because it's all documented in the six-page private detective's report that I was unceremoniously read the next morning. And what happened was that... at one time, I had parked somewhere downtown, and I came out of the King George, I believe it was, or maybe it was the Senator. And that was the other thing I did is, you know, I was a real classy guy at first. We'd go after work, and we'd go to Taverna or somewhere, a nice place, and have a beer. And then when everyone else left, I would go down to the Senator because I could feel better because I was with a lesser crowd. And so when I drank there, I was a somebody. And so that night I came out, and I didn't even know where I'd parked my car. I had walked, according to the private detective's report, I walked around four city blocks until I found my car. And I proceeded to get in my car and drive and ended up at a party. I had found out about a party there. And that's where I was till about 4 a.m. when I went home. And there were other goings-ons. There were affairs. There were things like that. You know, amazingly enough, I haven't had an affair after I've sobered up. But at the time, that's one of the things that alcohol did to me. So anyway, this private detective report that was read to me, there were two guys following me. And it was read to me, and in there, at one point when I was driving down 8th Street, I lost them. And that's where my keen alcoholic mind jumped into high gear, and I was actually kind of proud of that. You know, like, here's this report of all my goings-ons, but you know what? Two guys trying to follow me, and I lost them. You know, isn't that, you know, I thought that was great. They couldn't even follow me. And it's just the way I believe that as alcoholics, we're wired differently. We think differently, we view the world differently, and that's why, to a great extent, only another alcoholic can help an alcoholic. And that's why Alcoholics Anonymous works the way that it does. So anyway, as a result of this private detective's report, I knew I had to do something. And I don't even believe I was the one that picked up the phone. I believe that she actually made the phone call to the central office here in Saskatoon. And arrangements were made that I was going to go to a meeting Sunday night. And a fellow by the name of Nestor came and picked me up and took me to my first meeting. And that was at the Mustard Seed Group, the same group that is my home group now. And what that did is that started a series of events over a period of months where I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to be able to say that I went to my first meeting and stuck, but I didn't. Shortly thereafter, we found out that we were pregnant with who's now my first son, Ryan. And so I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous for a little while, and I'd gotten real smart in 2-3 months. And I knew all that I needed to know, and I stopped going to meetings. And I stayed sober for a little while, but inevitably I drank again. And so I went back to Alcoholics for another couple weeks, another month maybe. And inevitably I stopped going to meetings again. And I was one of those ones that I really wanted to be a social drinker. I wanted to be able to do this on my own. I didn't want to ask for help. I didn't want to have a sponsor. I didn't want to read the big book. I'm not recommending that way to anybody. But that's the way I dealt with it. And so what happened on this one occasion, I was going to meetings but really not working the program. And I was bound and determined that I was going to be a responsible parent. And my first son was on the way, and I was on business in North Battleford. And I was up there for the week, and we had a Lamaze class. So I drove into Saskatoon to the St. Paul's Hospital. And we went to this Lamaze class, and because I'm going to be a responsible parent. I've got a son on the way. And so at the end of this class, what they did was they had us sit behind the mother, and we reached around and put our hand on their stomach, and they dimmed the lights, and they started playing some soft music. And this music was quite nice and was calming. And then this voice came on the tape. And the voice said, "Think of your best quality, your best characteristic, and pass that on to your unborn child." And that's the same silence that was in my head. I could not think of one single thing that I wanted to pass on to my child. And that ate at me. And that voice played over and over and over again in my head for months. And that night, when I left St. Paul's Hospital to drive back to North Battleford, where I had to finish up my work the next day, I got back to North Battleford in 45 minutes. And I really believe today, looking back, that what I was hoping would happen was that I would lose control and go off the road and hit a culvert or a phone pole and die, because I had nothing to give to my child. And when I got back to North Battleford, I did what this alcoholic does when he feels that way, is I went straight to the bar and I drank. And the next day, by then I did have a sponsor, and the next day I phoned my sponsor and I told him what had happened and that I was in North Battleford. He thought I'd ended up there on a binge, and so he didn't know I was staying for another couple of days to finish up the job, and he phoned my wife and said, "How's he doing?" And she didn't know anything about it, and so that created a whole other issue of problems, not on my sponsor's part, but on my part, because I guess I wasn't clear with him. I was trying to be honest as I could. And so anyway, I ended up back at meetings again, and I tried to do a little more, but you know, I had one more drink in me, and I still believe today, actually, I do have another drink in me. I don't know if I have another sobering up, but there's another drink there if I want it. I was back in North Battleford again on business, and by this time, my son had been born, and in my mind, again, my keen alcoholic thinking was that I'm going to be a responsible parent. Therefore, it's obvious that I will be a responsible drinker as well. I mean, the two go hand in hand. You've got to be responsible in all aspects of your life. So, in May of 1990, I was back in North Battleford again, and the NHL playoffs were on. And, you know, again, this keen alcoholic mind, I've got a 16-inch TV in my room. where there's that big 5-foot screen in the bar. So I went down to the lounge in the Tropical Inn, and I sat in the bar and I watched the Edmonton Oilers and the Boston Bruins play in a game that went into 2 or 3 overtime periods. There was a blackout in the game. It was a 5-hour hockey game. And I sat in that bar and I drank Coke. So I had proven to myself that I could go to a bar and drink Coke. And that just made sense that I was in control. I was responsible. So I went up to my room and I got my Coke and I went down to the Capri, a lower level bar, and I got drunk. Because that's what this alcoholic does when he thinks he can control things again. And that was the... I realized I had a glass of wine the next night with dinner, and I realized, you know, that I'd learned enough that I knew where I was going. And so I got back to Saskatoon. I went to my home group Sunday night, and with the strength of my higher power and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober ever since, and that was my last drink. It wasn't all easy, and it still isn't all easy today. And I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 16-some years now. A sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not just in Alcoholics Anonymous. But, I struggled with the steps. I fought the steps, and luckily for me, I'd gotten a sponsor that didn't put up with any of that crap either, and kind of like what you were talking about, Rick. We didn't have a contract like that. But he knew me, because he was an alcoholic as well. And, you know, he knew when I was BSing, and he knew what was going on, and he wouldn't let me get away with anything. And so sponsorship was very important to me. And, you know, he'd be the kind of sponsor that if I didn't phone him for a couple of days, he'd phone me. And all he would say was, "Is your finger broken?" And then he'd hang up, you know, because he knew that the onus had to be on me to phone him. The easier, softer way, which I wanted, was for him to phone me, you know, and bail me out or help me out, and he wasn't willing to do that. We had some great members in the Mustard Seed group at that time, and Henry B., who recently passed away, he would phone. If you missed a meeting, he'd phone. "Where were you?" You know, and I'd say, "Oh, I was at a hockey game or whatever, Blades game." "Did you sober up at the Blades game?" "Well, no, but, you know." And that's just the way it worked. And so I started going to meetings, and I started reading the big book, and I started trying to work the steps. And, I struggled with them, and I argued with my sponsor over some of them, and I had to go through a series of events to learn. I remember, in regards to step two, there was a day where, again, the marriage wasn't going so good, and so we were on the outs, and I'd gone to a meeting Thursday night, and I want to say that it wasn't a good meeting, but it was a good meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what really happened is I wasn't willing to listen that night, and so I didn't get what I needed out of that meeting. And so I went, and I parked outside of the Sutherland Hotel, because there was a payphone there, and I knew where this was heading. And I phoned all the names I had in my book, in my little meeting list, and nobody was home. It was Thursday night. There was meetings. There was late night shopping. Most of the people in AA go for coffee after the meeting. I didn't. There was nobody home. But for some strange reason, I got back in my car, and I went home. When the full intention of this alcoholic was that if there was nobody home, I was going in the bar and I was getting drunk. I believed that was my higher power. The next day, I went to my sponsor, and I told him what had happened, and I told him what was going on. I'd taken the day off of work. I phoned in sick, which I guess I wasn't physically sick, but I was sick, believe me. I had to sell my car to get some money. I had to leave the house. The relationship wasn't going well. I had to do this and that, and all these to quit my job, get a better job, all these different things. And my sponsor sat there, and he listened to me, and he said, "You don't have to do any of those today." And he told me what he'd like me to do, and he said he'd like me to go down by the Mendel Art Gallery and just sit by the river there and just take it easy for a little while. And And I left there, and I remember saying under my breath, yeah, okay, that's what I'll do. And there was no way I was going to do it. I had to do all these things. You know, in my head, my mind was going a million miles an hour because I had all this stuff to do. Again, I don't know why. I had no intention of going there, but I ended up parked at the Mendel Art Gallery. And I went down and I sat on a bench by the river there, and it was April, and the snow was melting, and the sun felt warm. And I was sitting there, and I started saying the Serenity Prayer over and over again. And then I ended up, I laid down on the bench, and I just kept saying the Serenity Prayer over and over and over again. And Judy referred to that, using that prayer and saying it again and again. And all of a sudden, my mind stopped racing. And I could hear the Canada geese out on the river. And I've heard Canada geese before, but it was different. And I felt the warmth of the sun, and I just started to cry. And then I remember hearing some footsteps go by, and I thought to myself, they're going to think I'm drunk lying here on the bench. But when I realized that my mind had calmed, I thought, okay, now is the time to solve all your problems, so that your mind's not racing. And try as I might, I couldn't think of a single problem. I couldn't think of anything. Of all the things I had to do when I got there, I couldn't think of anything. And I realized several days later that was my first glimpse of serenity. My first little glimmer of what it was like to have some serenity. And, you know, a couple weeks later, things weren't going well in the relationship, but I knew what to do this time. I jumped in the car and I went down, I parked at the Mendel, and I went and sat on the same bench. And I said the Serenity Prayer over and over again, and nothing happened. And I realized later that was the God of my understanding saying it's on His terms, not my terms. You know, and I had to learn that lesson. Step four, I was going to do the step four to end all step fours. I had a 2-week training course in Vancouver a couple weeks in December, not long before Christmas. People that know Vancouver in December, it's rainy, so, you know, everybody else on these training courses, I knew where they were going at night. They were going to the bar. I couldn't go to the bar, so I was going to do my step four. So I took a pad of paper about this thick, a box of pens, and I didn't take my big book. Put them in a briefcase, and off to Vancouver I went to do my step four. And actually, that must have been the follow-up course. It must have been in January. But anyway, that was right when the first Gulf War broke out. And so I thought to myself, like, why put yourself through the pain of a step four when the world is going to end? And so I sat in my room every night for 2 weeks, just mesmerized by this war on TV. Eventually, I got around to doing a step four. And again, it was probably 3-4 years sober before I did that. And I don't recommend that to anyone. There is a progression to these steps, but I don't recommend putting off your step four. But eventually, I got one done. And I had become friends with the minister of the church that we were attending. And he was actually taking me with him to a church meetings down in Fort Erie, Ontario. So we decided it would be a good opportunity to do my step five. And so I did my step five in a rather unique way, about 30,000 feet somewhere over Winnipeg. I did my step five with this minister that I was traveling with. And, you know, in hindsight, I've heard people say their step five didn't go very well, and I'm thinking, okay, it's a good thing it went well, because if it didn't, like, where are you going to go? You're on an airplane. You know, you can't get up and leave. So it went quite well. The woman in the seat between us, she was a little shocked at some of the things. No, there was no one in the seat between us. And the sound of the engine, and I was whispering pretty quietly. But the thing I remember about that step five that became very important to me was that Ray said to me, he said, Randy, it's now, you've been forgiven, it's now time for you to forgive yourself. And that was the part that became very important to me, and that allowed me to move on in my recovery. Because to that point, I hadn't been able to forgive myself. I'm going to skip over. I'm not going to do all of the steps. I do recall another incident, though, is I had always after that point, step six to me was I'd always had a backup plan in Randy's keen alcoholic mind. See, I still wanted to be a classy drinker. I had joined the Opimium Society, and we imported fine wines from Europe by the case. And I had a fancy wine rack downstairs, which, of course, you can't get rid of that. Even though you're in AA, you've got money invested in this. And I had a couple hundred bottles of wine. And I remember one day being downstairs and looking at that and the fancy corkscrew, the whole works. And I went in under the crawl space and I got the boxes out and I packed everything all up. And I phoned my brother-in-law and I said, "You want it? Come and get it. But come now." And I realized today that that was my backup plan, you know, because if this AA thing didn't work, I had a stash. And it wasn't going to work until I got rid of that. And so that's something I had to do. The other step, excuse me, they're all important to me, but the other step that's really critical when we're talking about a journey to serenity is step 11. Because my conscious contact with my higher power is directly related to my serenity. If I don't have that conscious contact, if I don't have that prayer and meditation, my serenity is out the window. I do remember I was listening to a member of the fellowship explain how they did their step 11. And when I was struggling with that, because I didn't know if I was doing it right, and you know, and he said that he got up every morning and he got down on his knees and he lit a candle and he prayed by candlelight. Oh, that's the way to do it. So I went out and I bought a case of candles. And they sat beside my bed for 6 months. You know, I procrastinated all the way along. In hindsight, I'm one of the fortunate ones, I guess, that got through it in spite of my, you know, not doing things right. But today, I do that step to the best of my ability on a daily basis. And, you know, I recognize when I haven't made that contact, I recognize that because my day's not going well. You know, and I wonder why are things not going well? Well, because I haven't gotten up and done my morning prayer and meditation. I hit the snooze button and I hit the shower and hit work. And halfway through the day, it's a mess. You know, but I can stop. I can close the door on my office and I can pull the big book in my drawer out and I can do a little reading and I can do a prayer and I can do a meditation. I can start my 24 hours anywhere in the day. It doesn't say it has to start at midnight or it has to start at 6 a.m. when I get up. I can start at any point in time. Somewhere along that line, we had a second child. So now I have two boys. They're now 17 and 14. I can say that they have not seen me drink, only because the 17-year-old was too young at the time, and he was about 6 months when I quit drinking for good. I talked about having nothing to give to those children. About a year and a half, my youngest was about a year and a half when their mom and I split. And that was tough. I actually left that relationship. I had changed. I had grown. She had gone to one or two meetings of Al-Anon and decided that wasn't for her. Probably a lot like Judy. She didn't think people should be sharing in public and tears, oh my goodness, and things had changed, and the damage that I had done through my drinking, and it just wasn't working. It wasn't a good scene. But a couple of years later, when I was sitting on the couch, I was home on Friday on a day off, and I don't know why I had Oprah on that day. I don't generally watch those shows, but Oprah was on. And the question to her audience that day was, if the world was going to end in 6 months, what would you do? And the first guy in the audience had fired up his arm. I swear he's an alcoholic. I've never met him, but just the way he thinks, it's like me. He said, "I'd move in with my mother-in-law because it'd be the longest 6 months of my life." The point for me in that was that I knew instantly what I would do. And it just came to me without any thought whatsoever, is that I would take the boys camping to a mountaintop I take the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with me, and I would teach them what I had learned about life through my experiences and through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that came to me instantly. I didn't have to think about it. You know, and that was from somebody that had absolutely nothing to give to his children. When Ryan was about 5 or 6 years old, he was up at Christopher Lake. His mother had a place up there. And I got a phone call. He'd been brought into the hospital. He had a severe staph infection in the elbow, and they were doing surgery within a couple of hours. And the thing about staph infections, they never know whether they get it all out and get it all cleaned up, or whether the infection gets into the blood, and the thought was that he could die. And I took a week off of work, and I went up and I sat with him during the days, and then I went to a friend's at night, and his mom came in and stayed with him overnight in the hospital. And I sat with him during the day, and I just sat there and I held his hand, and there was this terrified little boy hooked up to IV and his arm immobilized in surgery, and drains being changed every hour and bandages being changed, and I was able to just sit there and hold his hand. And he talks about that today. You know, and I had nothing to do for him, nothing to give him. And there was a point where the nurses come in, you know, and they're doing the best they can, but they're a little rough, and they're ripping off the bandage, and they're plugging this in and pulling this out, and he's screaming, and he looked at me and said, "Dad, can you change it?" And so I asked the nurse, and she showed me how. And for the latter part of the week, I changed his bandages. That was an incredible experience. His mother and I have an excellent relationship today. Their mother. We talk to each other every day about the kids. I mean, out of necessity. We've got two boys running all over the place, hockey this and golf that, and we do that out of necessity, but we have a great relationship. One of the things I had to do was I had to change, and just a little story on that was, you know, of course, because they're living with her, but they spend a great deal of time with me, but I'm making child maintenance payments. And for the first little while, when that payment was due on the last day of the month, I'd take the check down to the post office, and I'd look at my watch, and at 11:59, I'd slip it in the mail slot. Because I knew it would take a couple of days to get there, and ha-ha, you know, I'm getting back at you. Now, what I do is I just cut 12 post-dated checks on January the 1st, and she's got them for the year. And, you know, our relationship got better. None of the people around me have really changed, and yet my relationships have gotten better with them all. One of the things that I never had much of a relationship with my dad. My grandmother's funeral a number of years ago, I was able to, after the funeral, give him a big hug and tell him I loved him. And now we end all of our phone conversations with each of us telling each other that we love each other. And I never thought that I would ever hear that from that man. He probably thought he'd never hear it from me either. You know? He hasn't changed. Everything that I have today, I owe to my higher power and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, including my third wife. I don't know about vultures. She's kind of accused me of stalking her. I followed her to a couple of meetings. And then she announced that she was leaving her job and going to Wichita, Kansas to do her PhD. So after 3 months of dating, I asked her to marry me. We got married, and we have the perfect AA marriage. I say that facetiously. You know, it should be perfect in my mind, my keen way of thinking, because I'm an AA, she's an AA. I mean, it's got to be perfect. We both work, you know, everything just works fine. Well, the first year was great because she was in Wichita doing her PhD. I was here, we were on the phone, all lovey-dovey, everything's great. And then she decided to come home and live with me. Well, when we would get into disagreements, I wanted to leave. She has issues around people leaving. So she's blocking the door. I'm trying to get out. It wasn't good. I'm telling her she needs to do a step 10. I need an apology for that. She's telling me I need to do this. She's the smarter of the two. I give her that because what happened, well, I don't know if she's smarter. She started coming to my home group First, he'd phone my sponsor and tell him what I wasn't doing, and he'd say, have Randy phone me. Then she started coming to my home group and trying to tell them what I wasn't doing. They had a couple of Al-Anon people meet her at the bottom of the stairs one night and take her downstairs while I went upstairs. And she was kindly told, she's probably the first person ever kicked out of an AA meeting and not allowed to go back to that meeting. She was told she needed to be going downstairs to Al-Anon, and she did for a number of years. And we worked things out. Life is not without its challenges. We decided that it was time to have children of our own. And over a period of about 8 years, we had 6 miscarriages. Most of them in the second trimester, when things are supposed to get easier. And the first one actually was right at the end of a provincial assembly in Regina, and we drove back, and she wasn't feeling well, and I dropped her off at home, and I went and I came back, and it was a mess, and it's taken a lot out of us. It's taken a toll. She has a list. She's a list person, and she has that same list that Judy has, you know, as to why. We think we're doing everything right, and you know, we can't. She works in the healthcare field, and she sees people on drugs and smoking and drinking and having healthy children, and we can't. And you know, but Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, because she was going to Al-Anon at the time, got us through that. The people would come over, and a lot of times they didn't say anything. It was just having them there, kind of holding our hands, just like I held my son's hand. We have a different challenge today. We have we've given up on trying to have children. We're both getting a little on now. But she wasn't happy in her career, and she was in depression over this. So again, being smart, she had a PhD. She wasn't using it. She wanted to be a professor. There was a job in Minot at the university where she had done her master's. I said, oh, throw your name in. Why not? Well, they offered her the job. And so then I had to follow through with that commitment. And so for the last 2 years, she's been living and working in Minot, North Dakota, and I'm living and working in Saskatoon. And my job skills aren't really transferable down there. So we've been doing a commute back and forth. And for the most part, that works pretty good. We see each other every few weeks. That's where I was in Vancouver 2 weeks ago, down there last week, and then back Thursday night, and then Wilcox, and then here. And that's where, within half an hour of being here, you know, I calmed, because I've been very busy. The difficult part, again, is me. I get into a routine when she's not here. She came home for the summer. I came home at 5:15 from work, and she was sitting on my couch. Don't you know, I lie down on that couch and watch the news at 5:30. Like, you get off my couch, you know. She was sitting around not working this summer. She'd move things, you know, and I'd come home, and that's not where my chair goes, you know. But we work through that. We can talk about those things now. And I never did that before. That would have been an excuse to drink before. You know, and I've had to learn to talk about my feelings and talk about things with her. And she's had to learn. And we've gotten over that, me wanting to run and her wanting to keep me in. And you know, sometimes I'll just say, I need a little space. Because I still know that in spite of, I wish I could say I had 24-hour day serenity, but I don't. But in spite of what serenity I do have, I still tend to say things that I don't really mean, you know, on occasion. So sometimes I'll just say, I need a few minutes. And she'll give me some time, and I need to think through my thoughts, you know, and figure out what it is that's driving me nuts that I need to talk about. And we work that out for the most part. And things are pretty good, in spite of living in two separate countries and all the other things that we deal with. I got involved in service about 12 years ago. I said at our home group meeting that I'd be willing to be the alternate GSR, because, of course, the alternate doesn't have to do anything, you know. 3 months after I said that, Kim L., and someday I'll deal with that resentment, moved to Regina, and I became the GSR. And I've been active in service for the last 12 years. Service in Alcoholics Anonymous has just opened so many doors. I didn't realize at the time, I mean, that Alcoholics Anonymous was anything more than my home group. You know, and all of a sudden you're going to these provincial assemblies and you're meeting GSRs from all over the province. And then I became a table officer and we started visiting other provinces in Western Canada, and I realized, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous was all over Western Canada. I had the wonderful, wonderful opportunity to become the delegate for this area and attend the General Service Conference in New York and see all of the delegates from all over North America come to the General Service Conference and see how that works and learn to. I remember the first time I heard trust the process and I went, what? You know, but I learned how to trust the process. And today I find myself telling people, trust the process, and they're looking at me like I'm crazy. Probably the most spiritual experience of that whole experience was sitting at the General Service Conference in New York 2 years ago and listening to Bob and Bill on they were doing an archives project at the time, and they had these wire recordings that they're transferring over now because these recordings are losing their recording. And so sitting at the General Service Conference with all the other delegates from all over North America and the trustees and listening to Bob and Bill speaking, it was just an amazing, it sent shivers down my back. Just an amazing experience, an amazing opportunity, and I owe it all to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. There were many times where I put up my hand to do something, not knowing if I could do it, but knowing that if my higher power thought I could, he'd put me in the position, and with the love of the Fellowship, I'd learn to do that. And that's what service became for me. When my term as delegate ended, just a year ago, I've had the opportunity as past delegate to go to our assemblies. There's one next weekend in Swift Current. But I also got involved more locally, and I'm on the Roundup Committee here. It's very important for me to just try and give back a little bit. And, you know, for every little bit I give back, I get tenfold. It's amazing. So if there's anybody out there thinking at all about getting involved in service, talk to your sponsor. Pray about it. And if you think you have the time and you have the willingness, put your hand up and leave it up to whatever fellowship you're in and your higher power to decide whether you get that position. I want to close with something. I'd like to say I don't normally get teary-eyed at the podium, but Val and Keith would say otherwise. I used to stand in front of the assembly and just cry out of tears of gratitude. On my 14th AA birthday, my boys gave me a card. And I just want to read you what my youngest son wrote. He was 13 years old at the time. I guess he was 12 at the time. He wrote, "Wow, Dad, 14 years of no drinking. Congratulations. That's such a long time. I'm very proud of you, and you have set a good example for me. Congratulations again. Love, Christian." And that's from somebody that had absolutely nothing to give to their children. And really, it's through very little that I've done. It's all through the grace of my higher power and the help of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank you for the opportunity to share today.